Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine, and I'm Chef Cindy Wolf.
I'm Tony Foreman.
And we are talking about champagne. And so, Tony, we were just talking about vintage champagne. And so you were just saying that each house chooses its own vintages.
Everyone in Champagne will tell you, these guys are so smart in business. Everyone in Champagne will tell you the most important wine they produce is their non-vintage wine. And the wine that's the highest quality and the best price is their non-vintage wine. That's because even the lousy years gives them product that they can use mm-hmm. to make wine that they can sell, and you can't really complain about it so much because it's not their grand marque. It's not their reputation's not riding on it the same way. It's a good model, especially in a cool wine growing region. Non-vintage champagne is usually made in a particular style and made with the large bulk of what the juice is that they have. Vintage champagne typically is from certain sites, certain years that have very particular and distinct expressions of that site and of those years. And once in a while, you have these very old-fashioned guys that do non-vintage bottlings only from certain sites, which sometimes, I mentioned Guillemandier's Cramant bottling is one of those things that for me, and it doesn't fit the economic model with the others. So sometimes these things sort of get priced in a funny in-between place. But if the fruit is all from a Grand Cru site and the guy's good at making it,
I'm sure it's delicious.
Sometimes you have a very, very interesting purchase.
Right.
And beautiful wine in that.
Well, it makes it more accessible, you know, when you have a non-vintage and price is lower.
Well, non-vintage bottlings are meant to be drunk straight away. Although it's funny, like Bollinger, for example, I almost always rather have Bollinger in the cellar of the house for a year before getting into it than mm-hmm. having the stuff that's just arrived.
And why is that?
It just continues to develop.
Okay.
The wine definitely continues to develop.
Okay.
The better the non-vintage that you buy, the more like Bicar Salmon, an opposite style.
Mm-hmm.
A quick thing about Cru's, Grand Cru's, Premier Cru, because you see those on labels too.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about champagne labels. The Grand Cru's, there are a limited number of villages that are considered the best sites. And the vineyards around those villages, like Ambonnet or Bouzy or Maury or Chouy, and Vertus, there's all kinds of, Cramant, like I said, both in the Montagne de Reims, and which is the sort of the big Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, the two red grapes, that big area, those villages, or the Côte de Blanc, the area a little bit further south near Epernay, famous for Chardonnay. Those Grand Cru villages, they get the highest price every year. So the quality of the vintage, they set a price for the year. And if you can get 100% of that price, those villages, that 28 villages or whatever it is, they get 100% of that price. And then there's a next ranking of villages, the vineyards around them, they will get, 97% or 92% or everything from 90 to 99% is Premier Cru. There's a very big difference in Premier Crus that are 91%
sure.
and 99% as far as the quality of the site, and usually has a lot to do with the minerality and the interest in the soil, not so much just the ripeness and the quantity of fruit that's produced. But it's kind of an interesting, it's an incredibly organized, collectivization and commercialization system for all the fruit for the farmers.
We were talking a little bit earlier about the chalk in the soil, or the soil is chalk. How do you feel that affects the flavor of the wine or the taste of the wine?
Well, wine.
How does that translate?
Any wine grown anywhere is going to reflect not just what the weather was, but most of the plant is under the ground. The plant translates rainwater through the earth into fruit, right? So mm-hmm. through photosynthesis and making the berries reproduce. So that entire process, the story of that whole process, and most of it happening underground, is told by that plant and ends up being expressed by the juice of that fruit. If that soil is kind of a Johnny One Note, vines adapt to soil also. There are places that, there's certain vines that, it's like a voice. there are certain voices that know how to sing a certain kind of song. You know, that the Champagne region has a lot of chalk in the soil, and the Chardonnay, the Pinot Meunier, and the Pinot Noir that grows there in the best sites, they know how to sing that song. They know how they can sing that almost like, I guess it's funny, immediately I think of like Baroque choral music or something that is inherent in that chalk soil, very different from, let's say, the graphite that you might get from the gravelly soil in the Medoc, you know,
sure.
Or the clay in the Côte de Beaune. I mean, Chardonnay is what you see in the Côte de Beaune and Montrachet, but that clay, that's a very different piece of music from the tune that's sung and the style of it that's available to be sung up in the Côte de Beaune.
You said there are three different grapes. How do you know what the Champagne has been made with?
Well, it's sometimes you'll see on a label Blanc de Noir, which means it's from red grapes. So the two red grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, and Pinot Noir adds, when it's in a blend or if it's in Champagne, you look for it to add some level of textural structure, and you look for it to add some level of red fruit breadth to the wine. And often if there are tones that run mineral to metallic, it's coming from Pinot Noir. Pinot Meunier can be floral, almost like a raspberry. When you taste the Von Clair, there is like a golden raspberry fuzzy thing that's particularly...
I like that.
Pinot Meunier grown in a really good site. Like Selec has some great old vine Pinot Meunier that yields really low quantities of fruit that are really great high quality, have great intensity and a very particular nerviness to them. It's not quite as ponderous as the fruit from the Pinot Noir. And the Chardonnay that's grown is very different from what you think of, say, in California Chardonnay or even in France in the Côte de Beaune or something. It's much more, and different from Chablis, even though the soil is similar, it's much more searing. It's not as ripe. It just hasn't had the sun.
Doesn't get the heat.
Skin, yeah. The skins that are involved, that's one of the things you don't think about with the grapes. Grapes are the flesh, you know, and the skins. And if the skins, they get different kinds of sunlight, they ripen very differently. They give you different textural elements when you crush those grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Chardonnay is very different texturally. There's a crunchiness to it that translates into something that is very long and very pervasive. And I think the longest-lived champagnes almost always that I've had that had real vibrancy at great age, there's a spine of Chardonnay that holds it together. And something of, it's not the flesh, but it is the facial structure or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you remember, I think, when I've tasted the older stuff that was remarkable.
I think a good example of understanding kind of the how a grape works is, have you ever had a muscadine grape? Aren't those what grow locally? Right, and when you go to squeeze that in your mouth and you eat, because you don't eat the skin of that because the skins are so thick,
most wine grapes, that's the...
Yeah, you put that first bit of fruit in your mouth, and then if you really squeeze that skin hard, then you get all that sugar that's right next to the skin, and that's it's just
but
so...
But then you get also
kind of
the
good...
tannins from the skin itself
mm-hmm.
that are flat-out furry, and it's like tea bags that have been sitting in your,
exactly.
in your iced tea bucket in your fridge for 2 days.
Right.
It just makes your teeth hurt
mm-hmm.
straight out. It's funny, in thinking about champagne and how to use it, and a lot of people save it for special occasions and things like that. I certainly prefer it for all kinds of, because of the flexibility with food, I prefer it for all kinds of food, and I prefer it for any kind of different situation. If let's just say that Cindy Wolf is a new champagne house, and she wants to sell some wine, and people come to visit and taste her wines, what are the dishes she's putting out? What are the things that she wants to have to show off the wine?
I really do love oysters with champagne, whether they're raw or fried. I really, with a rosé champagne, I love squab and magret. I think that depending on, particularly if with the foie gras you have a little bit of a fruit.
So rosé, champagne, red meat, birds.
Yeah. I really think that those are beautiful, particularly for me, with foie gras in particular, so let's say you have a preparation with magre and with foie gras, I like to pair the two together because it's the same bird. The acidity in the champagne just really cleans that up, or just kind of, you know, just really sort of targets the foie gras fat. So, and the magre has a lot of fat too. So I think that's another reason why I really love that champagne. And as you were saying earlier, that the bubbles actually give you a feeling of acidity, right?
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. So, you know, I understand that even better now that you've said that. And while we're talking about, you know, food pairings and rosé champagne in particular, where does the color come from in a rosé champagne?
A food dye, red dye number 6.
Oh.
No. No, actually.
Wow.
Surprise. No. Uh-huh. And a lot of rosé champagne is not made only with red grapes, by the way. And the easy solution, you think, the one that comes to mind is, oh, they leave the, you know, one is, how do they make the wines, champagne in general, you know, look like white wines in color with the red skin grapes? Well, one, the red skin grapes don't have a lot of color because they're really far up north and the color barely changes on them, one, and they're thin-skinned. So there's not a big ratio of skins to juice. That's one. Two, they don't macerate the fruit with the skins, the flesh with the skins for a long time. They remove them pretty darn quickly. You can make rosé by doing that, by leaving the skins in a bit longer. Skins in champagne usually ripen pretty inconsistently. So you'd end up with a very inconsistent product if you did that a lot of times for rosé champagne. What most growers will do is have a little bit of their still red wine, a red Vinclair that then is added, made from Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, or a cocktail of the two. That's what's added. Sometimes it's older wine. Sometimes the oldest thing in a non-vintage rosé is blend is the red wine that's added. And it may just be 5-7%,
okay,
maybe up to 10%. There's some producers.
Yeah, I always thought that the color
super
came from
light
the
and charming.
Skins.
No.
The Pinot Noir, I didn't.
Sometimes
okay,
it's super
really
light and charming.
Well.
I mean, recently had Lanson Rosé that, I mean, literally someone waved a red grape over the glass. You know, it mm-hmm. was just as bright and it almost silly. It had like a tiny little kiss of color to it, and it was zero effect from the red grapes. And there's another producer, René Geoffroy, who's from Coumières, who's famous for making great, big, vibrant, powerful rosé champagne. Well, Coumières on the south slope of the Montagne Reims get some of the ripest Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. He puts, not that old, the red wine that he puts in his rosé, so it still has a little tannin to it. You know, the thing is, if those skins have decent tannin to them, you know, when you make that red wine, and those wines are firm, the still red wine from Champagne is pretty firm, tart stuff. I mean, it really is for, Andouillette is great for still red wine from Champagne, because it is big and vulgar and gamey, and that's you know, that is the dish for that sort of like tart, punchy, slightly tannic, lower alcohol red wine. That's what gets added. Bollinger's a house that they make a rosé with some older wine from Pinot Noir that goes into their rosé blend, and that always takes a little longer to come around than their regular bottlings, because you want it to resolve that tannin even.
If people were to visit the region, would they be able to go in and visit some of these houses?
Yeah, lots of big houses make it very easy. I would encourage people to visit big houses, little houses, to visit growers in different areas. If you can visit two small growers in two very diverse areas, like Pierry or Chouilly or up north, Bouzy, something like that, that's terrific. You get an idea of what a farmer, you know, like a grower, producer, what their work is like. And going to a big house, one of the famous houses that's been so good at the business for a long time, seeing their history and seeing how they do business and how they have to make wine.
I think
seeing their old caves is
Tatin-Jay was one of my favorite visits that we've had.
Yeah, those to me, I think the diversity of what is done and how it gets done is super interesting.
It's very interesting. And any restaurants that you in particular?
Well, the famous three-star, Le Crayer, Jean Boyer's restaurant, is crazy beautiful. It is not in any way inexpensive.
No, it's very expensive, but it's
it is
a beautiful,
remarkable
beautiful
setting, and it gives you a feeling of what, say, doing business might have been there 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, in the city of Chem.
When it would have been, you know, noblemen and some crazy wealthy merchant or something from England coming over for like a week stay to taste a few wines, be hosted, and, you know.
That's a beautiful property.
Ship crates and crates back to, you know, to B&G or something in London to sell for them. Or, you know, that's kind of crazy stuff. They have a, he has a, like a one star that's a very good purchase. I believe it's called Le Jardin. That's not that far away from where the restaurant is in Reims. And very good modern bistro stuff and a huge selection of champagne by the glass, which is super fun.
That would be great to go to.
The thing to do is to go with another person and split a couple of different things, mm-hmm. and taste different styles together. That's champagne,
fun.
Like any wine, is wine. You need to taste to learn.
Right.
You know,
right?
It doesn't have to be thrown back like those guys in the back room like you're talking about.
1820s or
knocking
whatever.
Out those old yeast cells and getting caught in their beard or whatever.
Right.
So here's a silly food question for you, Sin. So what is your favorite thing that makes no sense at all food-wise for champagne to have with champagne?
Gougères,
or that's not traditional.
Gougères, which is a
that makes total
Burgundian
sense.
Cheese pastry.
Mm. Oh, that's
they're the best. It's
you're going 2 hours up the road. You're not going. You're not
right,
going
it's
wildly
not that far,
outside of
right?
the zone.
Right, that's true.
I thought you were going to mention sushi or nigiri or
mm-hmm, no
some kind of so, you know super interesting.
I'm sure that would be
very
wonderful.
Not French food. It
I'm
is,
sure that would be amazing.
Is.
But
I will admit that that's my answer.
Yep. All right. There you go. Gougères are a dough made from. You can either use milk or water, milk, butter, flour, salt. I put a little bit of black pepper and cayenne pepper in, and then you once the dough is made on the stove, you have to really kind of have a heavy bottom pot and a good wooden spoon, and you just kind of knock the dough around. You want it to steam a bit to remove some of the moisture, and then at the end you very laboriously have to add one yolk at a time, and then finish with Gruyere cheese, and you pipe them out and bake them in the oven. And I can certainly put a recipe up for gougères, but
yeah,
they are one of the best little hors d'oeuvres, and not that hard to make. So it was great to talk about champagne. It's such a beautiful wine to, you know, really enjoy all the time, not just for a celebration.
It's a fascinating subject for sure, and great with a lot of different food. Thanks for listening. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We'll see you next time on WIPR.